do. And some of us are pushing as hard as we can with everything that we can.
Tara Haskell, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Gyirnu Collective, Ojibwe from the Kochiching First Nation, speaking to us from Minnesota, where she was just recently arrested, hospitalized, put in solitary confinement, and now out, brutalized with police shooting rubber bullets at her. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video production fellowship and our digital fellowship here in our New York City studio. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tersena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadouris, and Alkaf Timri Astudio, John Hamilton. Special thanks. I'm Amy Goodwin-Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's COVID infection rates soar to 2020 levels. Joe Biden extends the federal eviction moratorium. And Governor Andrew Cuomo faces calls to resign over a sexual harassment scandal. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 4th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Yesterday, Oregon experienced its largest daily case count since January 9th. According to the Oregon Health Authority, there are 1,575 new cases, 9 deaths, and 379 patients hospitalized, including 119 in intensive care units. Governor Kate Brown has deferred COVID-19 safety regulation to the counties. Local authorities have been reluctant to impose new restrictions for fear of retribution. Oregon kept case numbers low while regulations were maintained on a state level. Since the statewide mask mandate was dropped, infection rates have risen dramatically. The new Delta variant of COVID-19 has been proven to infect and transmit between vaccinated people, although the likelihood of them becoming seriously sick is low. Oregon's so-called fifth wave of infections is worse where infection rates are low, including southern and eastern Oregon. However, Multnomah County saw its own case rate triple in the past 2 weeks. Yesterday, Portland's Burgerville chain announced that it was temporarily closing a restaurant at Southeast 92nd and Powell. A company spokesperson told Willamette Week, quote, "Police are now being called daily. Burgerville employees have found weapons, drug paraphernalia, and human waste on the property." The announcement was a surprise to the Burgerville Workers Union. The 92nd and Powell location was the first Burgerville to unionize in 2018. All 20 employees at the store are union members. The Burgerville spokesperson said, quote, "Employees are being paid for scheduled shifts and offered positions at nearby locations." Infection rates went down this spring with the vaccine rollout, but due to vaccine hesitancy, they're once again on the rise. Likewise, the strength of American democracy is swinging back and forth. With his thoughts on this connection is KBOO News poet Dan Raphael.
Life is full of pendulums. It's never just one swing. COVID kept growing, slowed by masks and distancing, till the vaccines reversed its swing. So we celebrated, started shopping, socializing, stopped masking, while fewer newly vaccinated hands showed up to push, and COVID swung back on a new Delta angle. The infections of anti-democratic power hunger and potential fascism have sprung up regularly, but civic vitality and integrity with regular injections of the voting vaccine kept democracy healthy. Then came the Trump variant. As the states with fewest COVID vaccines want to deny the voting vaccine, our immunity to lies and fear of others being suppressed by the media and politicians infected like Trump. Increasing COVID deaths are increasing vaccine rates, but how sick do how many have to get before folks realize what's being taken from us politically, economically, socially, and we figure out who and where we must push to get our democracy back in the swing of things, healthier than ever. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Chinook salmon are one of the most iconic species in the Northwest, but they are also endangered. Warm waters released from the Shasta Dam for California farms is expected to kill off huge numbers of salmon in the coming weeks, driving the species closer to extinction. Susanna Potter has more on the story.
Within the next several weeks, experts are expecting a massive die-off of winter-run Chinook salmon as they spawn below the Shasta Dam because the water is too warm for the eggs and baby fish, called fry, to survive. Conservation groups charge that the U.S. Bureau of Reclamations and the California State Water Resources Control Board allowed for the release of too much water to agricultural districts in the Central Valley earlier this year, which caused the reservoir to warm up. Rachel Zwillinger with the nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife says more than 80% of the winter-run Chinook salmon could perish.
It is a big step closer to extinction for a species that is already widely acknowledged to be one of the most endangered species in the U.S.
Farm interests say they need the water to keep farm production on track. However, the water and the fish it supports also are very important culturally to the local Winnemem-Wintu tribe. And experts fear the warmer flows could trigger large algal blooms on the Sacramento Delta, which makes the water unsafe for people and pets and threatens the outdoor economy. Zwillinger wants the state to review outdated water management rules and reject some of the priorities set during the Trump administration.
By failing to take a strong stand and update these water quality protections, we're letting things that Californians care about slip away from us.
The current water quality protections date back to 1995 and are supposed to be reviewed every 3 years. The California Water Resources Control Board has not yet completed the update process. It began in 2008. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service.
While Oregon's bootleg fire is now 84% contained, large fires continue to burn in the western U.S. and southern Europe. Yesterday, the Dixie Fire in Northern California grew to 124,000 acres. It is now the eighth largest fire in California history and only 35% contained. High temperatures and winds combined with low humidity have enabled its spread. Hawaii's Big Island recently experienced its largest ever brush fire at more than 40,000 acres. That blaze is finally starting to recede. The world's hottest spot for fires is the northeastern Mediterranean, particularly Turkey and Greece, which are experiencing higher than usual temperatures. In Turkey, wildfires have burned nearly 235,000 acres, compared with an average of 33,600 acres annually between 2008 and 2020. Turkey lacks firefighting equipment such as aerial tankers, and it has relied on its neighbors for support. With inland temperatures reaching 114 degrees Fahrenheit, Greece had 1,584 wildfires in July, compared to 953 in all of 2019. Yesterday, Greece reported 116 new blazes in 24 hours. On Monday, Italy's fire service reported responding to over 700 fires. The ocean floor is rich with carbon from decaying marine organisms. Human activity is releasing that into the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a whale dies, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. As it decomposes, much of the carbon that makes up its body stays on the sea floor. The same thing happens when other ocean creatures die, creating a carbon-rich sediment that builds over millennia.
We know that the seafloor is the largest carbon storehouse on the planet.
Enrique Sala is a marine ecologist and an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. He says that globally, the sediment on the ocean floor stores more carbon than all the soil on Earth.
But we are disturbing some of that sediment and that carbon because of bottom trawling, which is a destructive fishing practice that plows the seafloor with large and heavy nets.
Stirring up the sediment can release some of that long-stored carbon, some of which turns into carbon dioxide. Scientists are working to determine how much of that CO2 escapes to the atmosphere and warms the climate. Having more CO2 in the water also makes it more acidic, which can harm ocean creatures. So to keep more carbon locked away in ocean sediment, Sala says it's important to protect large areas of the ocean from destructive fishing methods. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Since the discovery this summer of mass graves of children at Indian residential schools, protesters and Native activists have urged the Canadian government to turn over documents and open an official investigation. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
More than 500 people marched through the downtown of Canada's capital city, Ottawa, on the weekend. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they were calling for an independent inquiry into the country's former residential schools.
The rally was organized by opposition members of parliament for the New Democratic Party, Charlie Angus and Mamaluk Kakak. Called the March for Truth and Justice, it came in the wake of the recent discoveries of hundreds of human remains at former residential schools in British Columbia and Saskatchewan. MP Charlie Angus was one of the organizers.
We're talking about crimes against humanity. We're talking about children stolen from their families and left in unmarked graves.
After speeches in front of the Canadian Parliament, demonstrators then marched to the Prime Minister's office and the Department of Justice building, chanting, "No justice, no peace." Organizers say they want an independent investigation into all of Canada's crimes against Indigenous people. Here's MP Mamaluk Kakak.
Not just residential schools, but sanatoriums need to be searched as well. We know lots of Inuit were taken for tuberculosis treatment, and we know that lots of Inuit didn't come home.
Advocates have called on the Government of Canada and the Catholic Church to turn over documents related to the residential schools. The schools were funded by the government and run by the churches. 150,000 Native children were forced to attend from the late 1800s for more than a century. Thousands were abused, many died. Recently, the remains of more than 1,000 bodies were found in unmarked graves at the sites of three former residential schools, two in British Columbia and one in Saskatchewan. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
18 million postage stamps featuring an Alaska Native Raven design were released to the public last week. A ceremony in Juneau, Alaska celebrated the first stamp ever designed by an Alaska Native artist. From KTOO in Juneau, Jennifer Pemberton reports on the importance of the design and its story to the Tlingit people who have been in the region for 10,000 years.
It's called the Raven Story Stamp, designed by Tlingit artist Rico Linnott Worrell. Worrell is the owner of the Trickster Company in Juneau, which is known for selling everything from skateboard decks to leggings with Tlingit formline designs. It was one of his items at the gift shop at the National Museum of the American Indian in D.C. that caught the eye of an art director at the U.S. Postal Service.
And he said he was really drawn to the kind of the feel of traditional kind of design work, but in a modern context.
Worrell says he was invited to design a stamp in 2018. The Postal Service gets tens of thousands of art submissions for stamps every year, and only 30 to 40 of them will end up in mailboxes across the country. This is a huge feat for Worrell as an artist, but for the Tlingit people, it's bigger than that.
He has a goal to tell the story of Indigenous people today.
Marlene Johnson is the chair of the board at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, the Native cultural organization that sponsored the ceremony with the Postal Service.
The story that we are all still here. We have been here for at least 10,000 years, and we will be here for 10,000 more.
Native Northwest Coast art is well known for telling stories through large forms like totem poles and dugout canoes.
But Rico had to tell all of our origin story on the smallest canvas imaginable.
The stamp has a form line drawing of a raven with a gold ball in its mouth, surrounded by stars. It's a depiction of the dramatic conclusion to the origin story of how Raven gave light to the world by stealing it from a box. For National Native News, I'm Jennifer Pemberton in Juneau.
Dr. Loretta Christensen will serve as the Indian Health Service's new chief medical officer. An enrolled citizen of the Navajo Nation, Christensen began her IHS career as a general surgeon. As the chief medical officer, Christensen will be the health agency's lead expert on medical and public health topics. For National Native News, I'm Tripp Krause.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Troutdale pharmacist Adrian Contreras on vaccinations and the Latino community. Then at 5:45, it's news from the BOO. Tonight's weather is warm, dropping down to about 66 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be warm, cloudy, and humid with a high of 84. Today in 1693, French monk Dom Pérignon invented champagne. The quote of the day is allegedly from Dom Pérignon. Come quickly, I am tasting the stars. Little Rock parents are suing the state of Arkansas over a law passed in April that bans mask mandates in schools. With the rise of the Delta variant, Governor Asa Hutchinson says he regrets signing this bill into law. Emily Scott has more on the story.
COVID-19 has given a whole new meaning to the term extraordinary session, as state lawmakers are in Little Rock again today to take up possible changes to laws they just passed a few months ago. They'll consider whether to repeal or amend a bill that bans mask mandates by state or local officials. In its current form, Act 1002 prohibits school districts in Arkansas from making face masks mandatory for students and teachers. Groups including Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families say this puts young children not yet eligible for the vaccine at risk. Pediatrician Gary Wheeler says in this latest COVID surge, the state has seen an increase in children hospitalized due to the virus, which makes him fearful for this school year.
The kids are sicker, and we have kids on dramatic interventions to save their lives. These are dramatic things that we did not see with the Alpha strain in the last season. So we are frankly terrified of what might happen.
Wheeler heads the board of directors of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Arkansas had its highest jump in hospitalizations in a single day since the beginning of the pandemic on Monday. Just over 36% of Arkansans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. On Tuesday, Governor Asa Hutchinson told reporters he doesn't support another statewide mask mandate, but wants the legislature to allow local school districts more flexibility to protect kids under 12. He noted much has changed in the state since he signed Act 1002 into law in April.
I signed it at the time because our cases were at a very low point. I knew that it would be overridden by the legislature if I didn't sign it. Everything has changed now. And yes, in hindsight, I wish that had not become law.
Parents in Little Rock also filed suit on Monday against the state over the mask mandate ban, calling the legislation unconstitutional. I'm Emily Scott with Arkansas News Service.
Pressure from progressives in Congress pushed the Biden administration to extend the federal eviction moratorium by 60 days. Congress failed to extend the moratorium before going into recess on Friday. Democrats called for party leaders Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer to take action. Representatives Cori Bush, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Pressley slept Friday on the steps of the Capitol to protest the moratorium's expiration. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the new moratorium is, quote, intended to target specific areas of the country where cases are rapidly increasing, which likely would be exacerbated by mass evictions. It will affect about 90% of the country. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, quote, I think the message here today is clear. It's that everyday people can make a change. We can't always demand better. Ohio prepares to redraw its congressional districts in anticipation of census results later this month. Members of the public voiced their concerns about creating more representative voting districts and preventing gerrymandering. Mary Sherman has more on the story.
New congressional and legislative maps will soon start to take shape in Ohio. The Ohio Redistricting Commission convenes for the first time this Friday ahead of August 16th, when the U.S. Census Bureau is set to release key demographic data used for redistricting. Janice Brock is with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative, which is a member of the Equal Districts Coalition. She says they're urging the commission to hold public hearings around the state to ensure transparency.
We aim to lift up the voices of Black, Brown, and immigrant Ohioans who have long been left out the conversation, unheard, underrepresented during the official redistricting process. We want to make sure people's voices are heard.
The commission will draw Ohio's House and Senate maps. State lawmakers are tasked with drawing the congressional map. Advocates have called on Governor Mike DeWine to convene the commission for several months and launch the Ohio Citizens Redistricting Commission to gather public input on the map drawing process. The Equal Districts Coalition is wrapping up a 10-city Fair Maps town hall tour this week, where the topic is how gerrymandering has impacted communities. Brock says to ensure people could participate during the pandemic, the events have been held online.
Also, some people really don't have the means to travel down to Columbus to share their story. So we thought we would bring this to the people, make sure that we make this process accessible and transparent.
Brock contends all Ohioans deserve a chance to weigh in on how their voting districts should be drawn.
When we let Ohioans draw the map, we can choose what hospitals, schools, and the resources funded in our neighborhoods. These maps will shape our lives, laws, and policies for at least the next decade.
Ohio will lose a congressional district, dropping from 16 to 15 as the result of new census data. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. I'm Mary Sherman reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
Federal COVID unemployment benefits are set to expire, and low-income women will be affected especially hard. Lily Bolke has more on the story.
Mothers are sharing their stories about how federal unemployment benefits and a guaranteed income initiative have helped them build safety nets as 26 states, including Tennessee, cut enhanced unemployment benefits months before they were set to expire. The American Rescue Plan included federal support for people who are unemployed, and the Magnolia Mothers Trust, in its third year, provides $1,000 a month for 12 months to at least 100 low-income Black mothers. Tia of Jackson, Mississippi, explains that cash relief has helped her maintain a safety net for her kids, but she adds she'll always want to be working.
You want to add on to your money, not decrease your money. You might have to go to the doctor. You might have to pay out of pocket. Your car might break down.
Tia's experience is among many that counter the narratives cited by Republican governors who ended benefits early, that people receiving unemployment are dependent on the system or discouraged from working. Studies show so far that cutting benefits hasn't boosted employment in those states. Another mom in the program, Sabrina, plans to study nursing, buy a home, and have her son attend a school with extra supports for his dyslexia. She says the federal aid was a big help, but adds either way, she'll make it work.
I guess I have to maintain saving-wise. I do coupon. I just put money to the side and I don't touch it. I think about what if life, what if rent, what if gas, what if emergency.
According to a 2020 report evaluating the Magnolia Mothers Trust, a little more than a quarter of mothers said they could pay their bills on time before the program started. Afterward, it was more than 80%. Advocates for workforce equity say federal supports like guaranteed income and unemployment insurance can help low-income women, especially women of color, cover costs and work toward long-term goals. This story was produced with original reporting from Kitty Flesher for Miss Magazine. This is Lily Bolke with Tennessee News Service.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been a vocal supporter of sexual assault victims in the past, but a recent independent report sheds light on his own sexual misconduct. Now President Joe Biden calls on him to resign. With more on this and other stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I've lived my entire adult life in public view. That is just not who I am. And that's not who I have ever been.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo denies allegations in an independent report that found he sexually harassed multiple women, some current and former staffers. New York Attorney General Letitia James said Cuomo retaliated against at least one woman for her allegations. President Joe Biden told reporters he believed Cuomo should resign. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has announced residents will be required to show proof of vaccination for indoor dining and use of fitness facilities starting this month. One-third of COVID-19 cases nationwide last week occurred in Florida and Texas. Congresswoman Cori Bush told reporters on the Capitol steps that she will continue her fight to reinstate the moratorium against evictions. The Missouri Democrat has been protesting outside the Capitol for the last 5 days.
People started sending me pictures of dockets, of court dockets, that were all evictions. We cannot continue to sit back and play with what can or what cannot happen, when something could happen. We need this done today. People's lives depend on it.
The CDC on Tuesday issued new limits on certain evictions. The new ban applies to areas of the country with high or substantial transmission of COVID-19 and will last until October 3rd. The Biden administration has acknowledged that the temporary ban might not be constitutional. More than 1,400 workers in West Virginia are set to lose their jobs this week when the Viatris Pharmaceuticals plant in Morgantown shuts down and moves operations overseas. Workers say they've had no response to their urgent request for help from Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. Plant worker Carla Schultz.
I'm just a year or two away from retirement, so I'm too old to go to school, I feel.
A new study shows Democrats could lose control of the House next year due to Republican gerrymandering in Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, and Texas. An analysis by the data firm Target Smart shows Republicans could win as many as 13 House seats simply by redrawing congressional districts in their favor. Former Georgia Representative Stacey Abrams.
In response, we have seen bills, legislation passed in 18 states already, with more bills pending across the country that would make it harder for every one of those communities to vote.
A police officer has been killed near the Pentagon Transit Center in Virginia. The Associated Press reports the officer was stabbed and a suspect was shot by law enforcement and died at the scene. The FBI has not provided further information about the incident, but said, quote, there is no ongoing threat to the public. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 4th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer tonight is me, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Dan Lizowitz, Trip Krause, Dan Raphael, Emily Scott, Susanna Potter, Mary Sherman, and Lily Bolke. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Stay tuned for my interview with Adrian Contreras, a Troutdale pharmacist convincing reluctant residents to get their COVID vaccination.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Adrian Contreras is a pharmacist and professional dancer in Troutdale, Oregon. He says he's seen a lot of vaccine hesitancy and misinformation in the city's Latino community. Contreras considers it his mission as a pharmacist to help folks get over their reluctance.
So, Adrian, could you tell me a little bit about what you've been seeing in your community as a pharmacist? In terms of vaccine hesitancy and also just in terms of communicating vaccine information.
You know, I've got I get a variety of different stories on the reasons why people don't want to, you know, get the vaccine. And I mean, they vary tremendously from, you know, you're looking at, you know, religious reasons to the government. I don't want to do it because the government's telling me to do it. There isn't enough information out there. Just recently, I actually spoke to a gentleman that literally he was in a sort of a family feud where part of the family didn't want to get the vaccine. The other family had been vaccinated. And it was just one of those things where, you know, you've got family peer pressures of different, you know, reasons why they will or won't get the vaccine. But essentially, as a pharmacist, you know, my goal is to just give them the information that they need to be really empathetic to, you know, their unique situation or reason. And then just try to give them the information that they need in terms of the three vaccines that are available. You know, with Walgreens and Walmart's and CVS, you know, we've all had a collaborative with Ad Council and COVID Collaborative that to give people the opportunity and information for them to get the vaccine, you know, making appointments for them, letting them know that the vaccine's for free, you know, they don't have to pay for it, incentivize them by, you know, giving them a $5 off here, $100 off there, you know, and just at the end of the day, just try to give them that information that they need and let them know that, you know, they're protecting themselves, they're protecting their families, you know, and it's just one step closer for us to get back to normal, essentially. So
in terms of effective outreach, have you found that hearing information from you has been helping people like get over that initial hurdle? Or is it more something that kind of happens, that travels like word of mouth, like within the family?
A little bit, yeah, actually. One of the things that I have noticed since, especially Walgreens, when they started their campaign with the COVID bus, especially in our community, I keep getting families that will come in at least like four or five family members will come in and they've heard of me or they've heard that I give really gentle vaccine. Some people actually have a fear of needles, actually, and that's actually been one of the hesitations that people have had. And I just the other day I had somebody actually tell me, yeah, I heard that you're at Walgreens, that you guys give really gentle vaccines. I'm just like, okay, well, I'll take it. So, but yeah, I mean, Walgreens has done a great job with you know, reaching out into the community with the local leaders, with radio stations. I had as we talked about before, I'm a dancer and performer, and they actually had an article in the Woodburn Independent, and I keep getting people asking me if I'm the pharmacist on that picture. So so it's a little interesting and funny at the same time. But yeah, we've been getting a lot of positive results.
Do you feel like Woodburn is prepared for this fourth wave of COVID and the spread of the Delta variant? Are vaccination rates there yet?
Well, I think we're still trying to get that first wave taken care of, actually. So I feel that now the information is really getting out there. I feel that we're getting people more on board with getting the vaccine. I think recently with some of the information that's been coming out, where especially with the Delta variant, that people that are ending up in the actual hospital right now, 90% of them are due to not having the vaccine. And that small 10% of people that are actually vaccinated that are ending up with a severe illness is usually associated with, you know, other chronic illness that they're, you know, dealing with at the time. But I think the information is really getting out there now. So yeah, I think for this fourth wave, I feel strongly that people now have better information. They're feeling more confident. They know that, you know, overall the vaccines are actually working. So yeah, I'm pretty confident that at least they're willing to get the vaccine now, which, you know, it's going to be a huge benefit to them. So
absolutely. To people who are hesitant to get the vaccine, not because of a lack of information necessarily, but because they buy into some of these conspiracy theories, how do you break through to people like that?
Just try to be empathetic, you know, just really trying to understand the psychology of the reasoning on their story, and really trying to personalize their story, listen to it, and just try to give them that information that they need, you know, letting them know that, you know, the vaccines work. With the percentages of them getting the vaccine and actually coming down with a variant, you know, that they'll be well protected. And to be honest, I try to make it like a very judgment-free zone in my pharmacy, mainly because, you know, people have very strong stories about the reasonings why they won't do it, whether, like I said, it's some of it's these conspiracy theories of, you know, the government, and some of them are kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, where they're joking around a little bit, but there's some sort of truth to, you know, the reasonings why, or just a lack of fear, or more like, not a lack of fear, but a little bit of fear. And I think also it's just having a little bit of that fear of needles too is one of some people's hesitations, that, you know, some people are not willing to actually say it out loud, but just trying to listen to their story is really the most important thing.
Yeah, it seems like getting stuck with a needle is a pretty worthwhile trade-off when it comes to contracting COVID.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's it comes up at least, I want to say, 3 or 4 times during my conversations with people, from really holding onto my hand really hard, or just, you know, even with parents and bringing their children nowadays, you know, we've got kids that are just very much afraid of needles. So it's being able to, you know, help them through the process, you know, having the parent there with them, and then just being super empathetic to, you know, their needs, essentially. So
you spoke a little bit just a bit ago about personalizing the epidemic and personalizing COVID. How have you been able to communicate that to people personally? You know, I think there's a lot of statistics that get thrown around about, like, 90% of people in the hospital are unvaccinated, or you talk about, you know, 400,000 Americans dead. I mean, that could be very overwhelming, and I think it can kind of numb people out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think from my perspective, it depends on the situation. If my story applies to them, then I definitely use it. You know, I really try to just let them know, you know, it's, you know, don't wait to have a family member get sick, or, you know, especially having that ability that if you have a strong family where one of you, you know, comes down with the virus, and you bring it into the household and potentially compromising everyone in the family, especially, you know, like your grandmother, and in my situation, my grandmother who passed away, you know, or a family member who has diabetes or other chronic illnesses that, you know, their immune system is already compromised to begin with. And having a strong sense of family in the Latino community, we like to get together on the weekends, and we want to see our family members and chat, and not really being vaccinated and bringing in the virus into the family. You know, you compromise everyone, especially our family our family members who are, you know, have chronic illnesses. And again, in my situation, you know, having that happened to my family in Mexico, where my grandmother passed away from it, and most of the family got sick because of that. And then in Eastern Oregon, coincidentally, 3 weeks later, when my aunt passed away for the same reason, essentially. And it's just, again, it goes back to just having that fear of getting the vaccine and waiting too long to get it before you have a tragedy happen. Like, don't wait for that to happen to you for you to really realize how devastating this epidemic is. So
transitioning to a discussion about a different community, you're also a professional dancer. I imagine that the response to COVID has been complicated for a community that's organized around an activity that just relies so much on close interpersonal contact.
Yeah, and I mean, it you know, the epidemic was devastating to the entire dance community. and you know, we're having to follow the mandates that Kate Brown put in place for the multiple counties. You know, it shut down businesses for over a year now, and a lot of these, you know, luckily most of them survived. At least the ones that I'm associated with, and as a community, as a dance community, you sort of try to. I mean, it's such a social community. You just try to keep in contact with these people through other means. You try to see how the businesses are doing, and luckily, because the community is very strong, there's a huge support system, a financial support system, to where a lot of the actual dance studios have been able to survive. But it's very difficult. I mean, you know, now we have to wear a mask sometimes. You have to be vaccinated if you want to actually participate in some of these social events. But before that, everything went to Zoom. So everything was, you know, if you wanted to take a class, you had to do it on Zoom with potentially your own dance partner or by yourself. So it's actually a breath of fresh air being able to be a little bit open again with some restrictions, but at least the community is still alive. So,
are you back to live shows then?
Yes, we are actually the team that I am a part of in Hillsborough for salsa specifically. They have actually traveled. This is actually Lions Dance Academy. They just traveled to this weekend to Phoenix. So they are going to be doing some live performances in Phoenix. And the academy is very busy. So luckily, they've been able to travel already. So. So yeah, it's been great. You know, they we have a very strong academy, so they're very very well sought after. So Phoenix this weekend, and I believe they were in Miami. They were in Miami 3 weekends ago. So we're pretty busy right now. So. Which is nice.
Yeah, it is nice. It must be kind of surreal, though, going back to just like almost business as usual after just a year and a half.
Oh, it is. It is. Oh, absolutely. I mean, not being able to, you know, not having the mask on. I mean, because we've been training this entire time, but we're training with a mask, which is hard. But at the same time, you know, it's you know, your stamina goes up a little bit. So as soon as you take off that mask, you feel... just amazing. So it's just amazing being able to go out there and then just do the things that we love, you know. In my situation, you know, just I love to perform, dance, you know, teach. So it's one of a great passion of mine. So,
and I guess it would be impossible to go back to that without vaccinations.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, if it was required for us to do that, then, you know, we have to go back to doing it, obviously, and we would, you know, we would just go back to doing Zoom like things were happening before. You know, it'd be unfortunate. I don't make most of my money doing this, but the academy does, so it'd be unfortunate for them to have to go back to Zoom and start you know, starting online classes again. They, you know, the academy makes most of their finances through privates and through live classes. So for myself, luckily, you know, I have a pharmacy to supplement my income. So, but no, yeah, it would be very difficult. So, yeah, hopefully it doesn't happen.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Adrian.
Yeah, Ethan, thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
That was Adrian Contreras in conversation with KBOO News about vaccine outreach in the Troutdale community. I'm Ethan Sandwise.